Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Let me be very clear, because I understand your technique, which you used on McCain, you used on Huckabee, you've used consistently, okay? It's unfortunate, and it's not going to work very well because the American people see through it.
So after the boxing match, posing as a presidential debate last night, and in advance of tonight's State of the Union address, Ryan Lizza, the New Yorker's Washington correspondent, is here. On this very busy political day, we'll talk about the debate and the Romney tax returns and Gingrich, Fannie and Freddie contract just released. And Ryan has a long article this week based on 5 years of internal Obama documents showing how he has tried and mostly failed to change Washington in a post-partisan direction. So, Ryan Lizza, thanks so much for coming on State of the Union Morning. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me. Quite a news week, huh?
Indeed. And let me start with one of the central moments of Romney on the attack from last night.
You said you were paid $300,000 by Freddie Mac as an historian. They don't pay people $25,000 a month for 6 years as historians. That adds up to about $1.6 million. They weren't hiring you as an historian, and this contract proves that you were not an historian. You were a consultant. It doesn't say that you provided historical experience. It said that you were as a consultant, and you were hired by the chief lobbyist of Freddie Mac, not the CEO, not the head of public affairs, by the chief lobbyist of Freddie Mac.
So, Ryan Lizza, A, do you want to fact check that at all? And B, what did you think generally of Romney as an attack dog, not in a custom role?
He was largely right. I mean, there's a technical, registering. Newt Gingrich did not register as a lobbyist, but I think to the average person, what he did was pretty close to lobby. I thought Romney in this role, you really have the style of contrasts, a contrast in styles here. Romney almost in a sort of prosecutorial fashion, very methodical, laying out a case against Gingrich, and then Gingrich's response are a little bit more populist. He's a little bit more of a demagogue, if it's not too unfair to use that word, and a little bit more playing to the crowd. So you've got the rationalist versus the demagogue in that little debate.
I'm always reluctant to be a pundit because that means trying to predict how people, unlike me, in a faraway state, are reacting to something. But do you think anybody won that debate? Did it take Gingrich down a peg and make Romney look like an ineffectual fighter or anything like that, in your opinion, regarding Florida GOP voters?
Well, on your first comment, you're considering that everyone has been wrong about this election at just about every turn,
over
especially
and over
about
again.
Newt Gingrich,
right?
It's very wise to be modest in our predictive capabilities. I don't know. I really don't know. The polls have showed Gingrich continue to gain ground on Romney. What has been present in this race from the beginning is Romney maintaining a 20-30% level of support, but it just seems very soft. It seems like the Republican Party is constantly looking for someone, or at the very least, they want to try everyone else out. They want to exhaust all the possibilities before they commit to Romney. And so it seems like the phase we're in now is that Gingrich is the last chance. He's the last possibility for the Republican Party to settle on.
But it's more complicated than that, even with Gingrich, I think, because he had one surge already in Iowa, you'll remember, and then the negative attacks from Romney's PAC started, and people got reminded, oh, yeah, gosh, it's Newt Gingrich. He did all this crazy stuff. And then he surged again, really defying the pundits. And now the cycle is going to that next phase again, where Romney is going on the attack,
right?
And I'm sure it's going to be on the airwaves in Florida all week. Hey, folks, this is Newt Gingrich. He did all this crazy stuff. And I don't know where that leaves the voters.
And what also shows that the voters don't pay attention the way that the insiders do. They don't pay attention to the whole campaign the way we do. They pay attention when it's time to vote. So when the voters of South Carolina looked up and they saw what happened in Iowa, they saw what happened in New Hampshire, and they made their decision based on that moment, right? All those negative ads against Gingrich that kind of nuked him in Iowa.
Plus, South Carolina is a perpetually angry conservative state. This is the state that elected Jim DeMint. their senator. And so I think what we also don't know is whether South Carolina Republicans are really representative of Florida Republicans, who are a more diverse lot economically, ethnically, otherwise, and Republicans around the country. Now, I do see that since South Carolina, Gingrich is doing well, at least as well as Romney, in the national poll of likely Republican primary voters. So, you know, it's possible not, but maybe there was a particular South Carolina populist angry thing going.
Yeah, look, Gingrich is a Southerner, right? He's from Georgia, so he had that going for him. The South Carolina Republican electorate, as you point out, is extremely conservative. We don't know for sure because the exit polls didn't ask this question, but it doesn't seem like Romney's Mormonism helped him among the large percentage of evangelicals in that who voted in that primary. I think only about a quarter or a fifth of self-identified evangelicals supported Romney. So certainly that raises suspicions about whether his religion was a major issue there. And you're right that Gingrich in that campaign did tap into a little bit of the populist sentiment that has really been the driving force in Republican politics the last couple of years, which Romney has never been, you know, he's never been natural doing that, right? He's never been the Tea Party guy. And Gingrich has, you know, Gingrich coming up in politics, Republican politics in the 70s and 80s, he was a Tea Partier before it was cool to be
right.
one.
Which brings us to the point of your article, which is that Obama, try as he might to be a postpartisan, keeps getting boxed in by the Republicans as if he's the divider. And I want to come back to that in a minute because I just want to finish up on the debate.
Yeah.
One interesting policy point that emerged for me, even though I thought that this was probably the least illuminating debate from a policy perspective for being so little focused on issues and so heavily focused on tearing the other guy down, you know, kind of more filling tastes bad, this kind of debate. But one interesting policy point that did emerge for me was almost a subtext of this accusation and response, Romney accusing Gingrich of being a lobbyist for the Medicare prescription drug program, Part D, which they see as big government. Let's listen to a little bit of that exchange.
You have congressmen who say that you came and lobbied them with regards to Medicare Part D. At the same time, your center was taking in contributions.
You just jumped a long way over here, friend.
Well, another area of influence peddling.
No. I'm proud of the fact that I publicly, openly advocated Medicare Part D. It has saved lives. It's run on a free enterprise model. It also includes health savings accounts and include Medicare alternatives, which gave people choices.
So, Ryan, the news from that exchange for me was that a President Romney or a President Gingrich would not dismantle Medicare Part D,
yeah,
even though the Tea Party has criticized it as Bush-era big government.
Yeah. Now, remember, the big, big problem with Medicare Part D is that it wasn't paid for. It was passed without any, you know, offsets or tax increases to actually pay for it.
Just like the Iraq War.
Just like the Iraq War, and just like you know, lots of spending in the Bush era, you can criticize Obama for a lot of things, but he's been much better at paying for his proposals. There were a couple moments like that where there was a sort of a mild defense of government that surprised me with both candidates. And look, Gingrich ideologically, and this is the problem that a lot of conservatives have with him, to say he's been inconsistent is a real understatement. He really has been all over the place in the course of his career. I pointed out before he came up in Republican politics in the 70s and 80s, but he did start at the very beginning as literally a Rockefeller Republican, worked for one of the Rockefellers' campaigns.
And I want to get your take on the dueling document releases. For Romney, it's his tax returns from the last 2 years showing he made about $42 million over the last two. We just say these things because there it is in front of us on paper.
Yeah.
And then you stop and think, $42 million.
Yeah.
And he paid the low capital gains tax rate of about 15% because this was all paper income, versus Gingrich releasing this contract that he had as a consultant or a lobbyist or a historian or whatever he was for $25,000 a month with Fannie and Freddie. Here's Romney on his taxes.
I pay all the taxes that are legally required and not a dollar more. I don't think you want someone as the candidate for president who pays more taxes than he owes.
Even that, Ryan, was an astounding clip to me.
It didn't make any sense to me. Well, yeah, I guess we don't want someone who pays more taxes than he owes. That's sort of beside the point.
Well, plus it kind of goes against the Republican attack line. You know, when people like Warren Buffett come out and say, it's not fair to tax my paper earnings at 15%. I should be taxed like any working stiff, like my secretary, I think is his line.
Yep.
And the Republicans turned around and say, okay, Mr. Buffett, you have the right to voluntarily pay more taxes if you want. And Mitt Romney just stepped all over that attack line.
Now, that's a good point. And what I think is happening here since South Carolina is that for the first time in the campaign, the idea, which I still think holds up fairly well, that is that Romney is probably the most electable against Obama of all the Republican candidates that ran, and it's not exactly the strongest field in history. Romney is probably the most electable. But that belief has really been tested since South Carolina, and Gingrich has been sort of prosecuting this case that Romney, due to his history at Bain Capital, due to the awkwardness of his wealth and the tax rate he pays, you know, these are all going to be Democratic attacks on Romney in the fall, and it is causing some people to wonder, well, maybe we got this wrong. Maybe this guy Romney isn't so, you know, as strong as we thought he is. Now, of course, the problem with that is Newt Gingrich is the alternative.
Right, but that was the essence, and I think some people miss this. That was the essence of the Gingrich commercials that were running over and over again in South Carolina about Romney, that labeled him a Massachusetts moderate. It wasn't just that he was a Massachusetts moderate. Those commercials ended with a line something like, as a Massachusetts moderate, he'll never be able to beat Barack Obama.
Yeah.
And whether you believe that or not, it went to the electability argument. And so for the first time in the three primary or caucus states, those who said they were voting on electability chose Gingrich rather than chose Romney.
That's right. He won those voters. You know, the truth is he won almost every demographic group that was broken down by the exit polls. Gingrich won. So he won across almost every category. But you're right about that. He won the voters who thought electability was the most important. And that puts a huge dent in Romney's argument that he's the most electable.
By the way, on the policy side, Newt's response on the tax rate.
I'm prepared to describe my 15% flat tax as the Mitt Romney flat tax. I'd like to bring everybody else down to Mitt's rate, not try to bring him up to some other rate.
So, pow, pow, pow. And, of course, Romney gets in trouble with the supply-siders like Larry Kudlow and CNBC and people like that because Romney is too afraid to suggest the zero capital gains tax rate that Gingrich and others suggest because he knows it would look like he's lowering his own grotesquely low tax rate as it is.
That's the irony here is when they crafted their tax plan, the Romney campaign, people were surprised that he did not go with conservative orthodoxy and bring that down to zero. Huntsman brought it down to zero. And obviously, I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure out the reason they did this is, as you point out, so it didn't look like he would be making a fortune off of his of his tax changes. But ironically, it's angered the sort of tax cutting right that he's not being conservative enough on taxes.
And the argument for the zero capital gains tax, besides having more money to invest back into the economy, is that it's double taxation, that the corporation, meaning the shareholders of the corporation, get taxed at the corporate rate when the money is first earned and then it's distributed as profit. So it's unfair to tax these same shareholders again as individuals. But
that's right.
It still doesn't look very good when you get Mitt Romney, who hasn't really done any work for that money in many years, and he's still taking out millions and millions and millions, tens of millions of dollars of dollars a year.
And it's the main source of his income right now. So the average working stiff who's getting an hourly wage, you know, might get taxed at 15 or percent or in the 20 in the 20s and Romney's down at 15.
Ryan Lizza, the New Yorker, Washington correspondent with us on WNYC. And tonight, the spotlight shifts for at least one day onto President Obama and the State of the Union address. Your article in The New Yorker this week is called The Obama Memos. What are these memos?
Well, these are I should clear this up because I realize that some people who read the piece thought that this was somehow an official White House leak or that there was some kind of full-scale White House cooperation in giving me all these documents to write a piece. I've noticed in some of the questions I've been asked. That's not the case here at all. This is the piece started basically out of frustration with a lot of interviews I've done over the last few years with officials in the White House. And I just started to realize that people's memories aren't so great. People contradict themselves. Sometimes they don't tell you the truth. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if you could do a long story, a sort of, you know, history of the Obama administration that was told exclusively through primary source material, documents that nobody could actually contradict because you had the quotes right there on the page. And what I've been doing really for quite a while is going back to sources again and again with a lot of patience and persistence and collecting records that could help tell me the story, and specifically on domestic policy. So, I've collected hundreds of pages of stuff over the last few years, and the story this week in the New Yorker is sort of the based on many of those documents.
And this is a long, long article. This is like pre-Tina Brown New Yorker.
But, yeah, I think it's almost 12,000 words, 11 or 12,000.
Amazing. And yet, your main point is very focused, as I read it. Obama has tried and mostly failed to change the polarized culture of Washington into a postpartisan one, yes?
Yeah, the piece is really about the constraints of being president. And I think every president learns this lesson as you shift from campaign mode to governing, you know, as Mario Cuomo said, from poetry to prose, you know, and as I say in the piece, as Obama shifted from Keats to Keynes, he learned that you're not the supreme power in Washington, that you have this thing called Congress and Fox News and Fed and all sorts of institutional constraints on what you can do. And the idea that you can march into Washington and change the political fundamentals is sort of a fantasy.
Central to this, I think, is Obama not being prepared for how the Republicans would try to cast him as the polarizing figure as an act of polarization. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. And, you know, I think there's always every president does talk about changing Washington. Every president talks about overcoming the partisan divide. We remember George W. Bush came to power on a message of changing the tone in Washington. And I think every president.
Compassionate conservative.
That's right. That's right. And I think every president comes to power with a different. I think some presidents really believe it, and some presidents only use it for rhetorical reasons. I think President Obama really believed it. I think it's who he is. And if you look at his, you know, I spent a lot of time in the piece going through his biography to point this out. So I think it may have taken him longer than others to give up on that idea, if he has indeed given up on it. But what it gives a lot of power to the opposition. If you come to Washington and you say, if you come to Washington and you define victory as bipartisanship, then you've given the power to the other side, because all they have to do to defeat you is to make sure that nothing is bipartisan. And I think that's what and that's clearly what Mitch McConnell in the Senate Republican leader, what he realized early on, that this was that Obama was being naive if he thought that this was going to be successful.
But is that too fatalistic? Is that to say that you can never do anything about the polarization in Washington, which everybody who's been there for a long time seems to say is much worse than it was even in the Clinton era when Gingrich was the speaker and everybody was running around saying, oh, my God, look how polarized it's become with all this Clinton bashing.
Well, look, when I started out on this piece, this is what the first thing I did was I went and said, all right, what is polarization and what causes it? Everyone talks about this, but why is politics more polarized? And you start reading the political science on this and you start getting into the material, and this is the fundamental feature of American politics of the last 40 years. The most important, the biggest trend in politics has been polarization. And, you know, what is polarization? How do you define it? It's the two parties have become more homogenous and ideologically more distant. That is, if you're a liberal today, you're not a Republican. 40 years ago, you could be a liberal and be a Republican. If you're a conservative today, you're just not a Democrat. So the parties have sorted themselves ideologically. So Obama, who wrote in his book Audacity of Hope very longingly about the post-World War II era, where it really was possible to have the two parties come together, sort of a consensus in the middle against the two extremes. It's you could do that then because the parties were not ideologically distinct. You can't do it today because the parties themselves have sorted. And why have they sorted? Well, you look into some of the literature on this, and the major reason is that demographically the American people have sorted themselves physically by moving to places of like-minded of people who with like-minded views. So what happens over time is, you know,
geographically, they're congregating into liberal and conservative congressional districts.
That's it. That's the key to polarization. And then you start, over time, your congressman becomes out of step with the people in the district who have become more ideological.
Except that we have a record of over 40% of Americans now calling themselves independents and disgusted with both political parties.
But you have to be very careful with this, the idea of independence. Everyone calls themselves an independent, but the true independents are shrinking percentage. They're down to 10 to 15% depending on the election.
A shrinking percentage.
That's right. The center really is vanishing. The independents, if you look at them, even the people that call them, the majority of people who call themselves independents actually routinely vote for one party or another. So the true independents, the true independents who don't know if they're Republicans or Democrats are very small. And those independents are ideologically all over the map. You couldn't think of one single policy that could appeal to them. So there's a lot of there's a lot of rhetoric about independence and the middle that is just wrong.
Huh.
We're basically in a country of 45 on one side, 45 on the other, and 10 that is ideologically indistinct.
That's
impossible for any president to change.
Ryan Lizza, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker on WNYC. So the White House is previewing tonight's State of the Union as a very specific blueprint for how we build a durable middle class. Is that a nice way of putting on the morning before the speech that there'll be a lot of fighting words in the way that he is coming around to now, giving up on post-partisanship?
Well, I was just sitting down before I got on the phone writing about this, trying to think through the debate here, because the debate in the last 3 years in the White House has been this debate between getting stuff done and changing Washington. You can come to town and try and change Washington, change how Congress operates, and there are sort of all sorts of process reforms you could fight for.
In other words, you could pass health care reform and have half the country ready to impeach you.
Yeah,
or
right.
Something else.
Exactly. Or you could spend your whole presidency on government reform, fixing lobbying, fixing gerrymandering, or whatever you think is causing or is at the root of Washington dysfunction, getting rid of the filibuster. So Obama could have come to Washington and made his entire agenda about government reform. Instead, I think wisely, he decided to, you know, pass his domestic agenda. The two are not really compatible, because as soon as you start getting into the government reform stuff, you're taking power from Congress. You're pissing off congressmen who you need to pass health care. So that's a constant tension. So I'll be curious tonight to see how they get that balance. How much does this speech return Obama to his sort of anti-Washington, post-partisan message, and how much is it purely about the economy and policies that appeal to the middle class?
Did you hear the discussion on one of the Sunday shows this week? And I can't remember. Once you've watched your dozenth Sunday show, they start to blend together. But it was whether the president would emphasize the word fairness or the word inequality when talking about economics and the American middle class this year. And the presumption was that inequality is a much hotter and more confrontational word, while fairness is softer and less threatening. Have you heard that distinction before as a matter of how he will fight?
Well, I think we've seen it, you know, in his recent speeches. This has been a constant criticism of Obama, that he needed to sort of give up on some of the sort of kumbaya rhetoric and start addressing what really is one of the fundamental trends that Democrats are trying to do something about, and that is income inequality. That's sort of at the root of a lot of Obama's agenda, but he doesn't really talk about it. He didn't sell his health care plan as something that would address income inequality, right? A number of his other policies are intended to address that issue, but he doesn't talk about it. Now, he has started to do that recently. The question is, have his recent speeches just been one-offs, or is this a sort of sustained case that he wants to make for the rest of the year?
So I guess we will see in the State of the Union address tonight. One last thing back to the Republicans before you go. Maybe if NBC had been moderating the South Carolina debates, there may not have been a Gingrich surge. The raucous audience made such a difference for Newt, plus John King and before that Juan Williams kind of teed him up for this anti-media populism. Brian Williams gave them no such opportunity last night, and they had rules about audience decorum, and they invited a more kind of professional, quiet, sedate audience. Is it possible that that would have made the difference?
You know, it's a good question, because that was what that debate was all about. Once you have the audience on your side, you've taken a lot of power from the press. And, you know, these debates, they're not really, as Karl Rove pointed out recently in decrying these debates, they're not really debates, they're press conferences. And what happens at a press conference is you're taking a lot of power from the candidates and giving it to the press. And what Gingrich was really sophisticated in doing, I don't know if maybe sophisticated is overstating it, but he realized one way to take some of that power away from the press is you get the audience on your side. So it is a great question. But we'll never know. We can't run the counterfactual, no.
Ryan Lizza, Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. His in-depth article in this week's issue is called The Obama Memos, about Obama's mostly failed attempt to change the culture in Washington. Thank you so much. Great conversation.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And folks, don't forget tonight at 9, a tweet up, a Twitter chat during the State of the Union address. Join me and others. Write down the hashtag WNYCSOTU. That's SOTU for State of the Union. So WNYCSOTU. Use that hashtag during the State of the Union as you join me and others from our It's a Free Country politics team tonight at 9 during the debate on Twitter. And you can also watch it live at itsafreecountry.org, our politics website.